Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 51, titled Buddhism and Nonviolence.
That the Protestant countries began to have a strong population increase. All the manpower of the country was available to the warlord, princes, dukes, barons, kings, whatever you want to call it. And they promptly conquered the world. You know, British, French were the two main ones with the sea power. And then the Germans, Italians, and Russians actually got into it after a while. And I think that the people they were conquering and genociding, like over here in America, in Africa, the Asian countries that they dominated, didn't really appreciate it. In fact, they didn't think Protestant Reformation, wouldn't have traced that to the Reformation and the destruction of monasticism in Europe. But actually, monasticism has a very balancing factor in a society, and it's a good place to stash violent young males who want to fight somebody. And then instead of watching Rambo movies and going off to some war somewhere and genociding some people, they sit there and they think about Jesus, or they think about Buddha, or they think about whichever tradition it is. Although mainly Christianity and Buddhism did monasticism. Hinduism didn't do monasticism until after Buddhist monasticism was suppressed. And then eventually they reconstructed a kind of Hindu monasticism. But before that, they were against monasticism. And so monastic, you know, Buddha, then that connected in my thought, which you're familiar with, but I'm just re-summarizing, that Buddha was raised to be a general as a member of the Kshatriya class and the warrior class. And once he became enlightened, he, on a social level, he knew how to organize things and people. And he kind of organized this army of mendicants, you could say. And India could tolerate that because of their economic surplus that they had compared to China or West Asia, or Persia or West Asia, because of the great wealth of the Indian alluvia, the agricultural wealth of the Indian alluvia, supporting a huge population and having tremendous surplus. And so that was not impossible in India. It was the place that it was possible. About seven centuries later, China began to accept reluctantly the concept of monastics, and the West Asia, you know, Egyptian fathers, Mesopotamian, Syrian monasticism began, and then finally European, about 700-800 years later, probably for cultural and economic reasons. So then the very first example of this is where Buddha's own country, the Shakya country, a city-state kingdom, gets destroyed by the neighboring city-state kingdom because most of the young warriors are mendicants. And so right away, the weakening effect on militarism by monasticism is seen right at the beginning. I didn't sort of pay much attention to that at first. I might have been more scared if I had. But I certainly then came to back to when I came back to see Tibet. Tibet had been a big conquering empire in Central Asia, overthrew the Tang Dynasty at one time, conquered into Nepal, Bengal, everywhere, Mughal-Ladakh, West Persia, defeated the Caliph of Baghdad, and in battle, Tibetan armies. And then 500 years later, they're a bunch of wimps. And oh, mani pe mehum. And then in the 20th century, and then they sort of last by diplomacy and so on, a few Mongol incursions, but really nobody conquers them until the 20th century, because the first British and then the Communist Chinese, Nationalist Chinese, never got there at all. They had no legation there until after 13th Dalai Lama died, although they pretend they did, but they didn't. And because it's very hard to go there, you know. Just try going up there and try breathing. You know, when you first go to Tibet, you try to take a picture. You know, when you're taking a picture, you're like holding your breath a little. You know, the older-fashioned cameras, without thinking, you kind of catch your breath when you're aiming that camera, not to move the camera. You might pass out. Have to be really careful. I know people who were taking pictures and they didn't inhale, then they start getting dizzy and collapse. And there really isn't enough oxygen, in other words. So So then you look at Tibet, and you see there where monasticism becomes this unique kind of society that doesn't exist anywhere else in history, where monastery takes the place of the army, basically, completely. So that's what I call a mainstream Buddhist society. And therefore, it gets devoted to nonviolence, but not perfectly, and definitely not all those monks are enlightened. Relatively, still a small percentage are, but many are at least enlightened to the extent of they don't go around bashing everybody else's head in. Actually, there were some monks who were like toughy monks, I call them, called doptos, who did have monk Olympics. They had wrestling matches, and they had like different kind of things, but they didn't really, actually, they were not up to snuff as far as Shaolin monks go. You know, they weren't really, they didn't have a tradition of martial art, actually. They just clunked each other around. They were a little bit more crude. But there's some fake books that pretend Tibetan martial arts, but that's fake. They didn't have martial arts. That was Shaolin who had that. Also probably from a Zen background, you know, the Shaolin ones. And then on top of it, to sort of seal the deal, you could say, or to prove the point for me looking at history, the Tibetans inflicted this style, social style, on the Eastern Mongols. Actually, then even the Western Mongols became very peaceful too after the 17th century, but they didn't do it through the same level of monasticism because of their setting. But they all did, and they became again pushed around by everybody else and wrecked and destroyed, by Mongols by the Russians mainly, and Tibetans by the Chinese communists. Russian communists and Chinese communists in the 20th century, totally wasted. But really, not particularly, it's not a personal thing, it just happened by them adopting modern industrial technology, which was still invented by the Europeans. And actually, you hear a lot of this thing from Chinese about how they were so given problems by the Europeans. But actually, the empire that was dominating the Chinese was the Manchu Empire, not the British. The British never really they didn't occupy China the way they did India. So they didn't get as pushed around by the British as they were already being pushed around by the Manchus, who definitely do not consider themselves Chinese in the ancient times, in the time of their empire. And they were very nasty to the ethnically Chinese people, in fact, extremely much. And when the Chinese Revolution in 1911, their battle cry of getting rid of the Manchus was getting rid of the foreign Manchus. Then later they kind of claimed that Manchus were some sub-variety of Chinese, but they don't culturally think so, actually. Neither side. So then you get this strange phenomenon since the 17th century, and since you have nation building happening in Europe, and I guess the beginning of modernity. You know, you have Louis XIV building the Fontainebleau, you know, and Versailles in France, and getting the dukes and barons of Burgundy and Bordeaux and Provence, etc. To come up to Dordogne, coming up to Paris and having Hotel de Ville, and therefore, in a way, being hostages of the royal bureaucracy, and in other European, and you have the development of different European empires, and rather than sort of regionalize things, you know, last of them to do that being Germany, that finally pulling Bismarck trying to pull Germany together because of the otherwise there's a very regional thing in the days of the knights, you know. And at that same time, you have a similar event in Tibet and Mongolia, but in the opposite direction, where the society turns inward, and they unify the life world, to use a Weberian phrase, the Lebenswelt gets unified, but not in the direction of secularism and disenchantment, but in the direction of sacralism and enchantment, 100% enchantment. And the military profession. Like to be a soldier in Tibet was like the lowest thing. It was worse than being a butcher. Well, mostly they used the Muslims as butchers, being hypocrites about their meat eating when they're Buddhist nonviolent. So they hired Muslim butchers mostly. Some of the nomads in the field couldn't do that, so they took the sin of killing a yak. But therefore they never ate fowl. They didn't eat chicken. They didn't like any meat where they had to have a whole life as one meal, if you follow me. They didn't like that. If they took a yak's life, then they wanted to eat it for weeks and months for less sin. Silly thing. Really kind of silly. And a few vegetarian Well, never mind. I don't want to get into that argument. But so they weren't able to, because of their economy, they were not able to be vegetarian, and then they rationalized it and Hippocratized it in various ways. But they did become basically demilitarized. That cannot be denied. There is a big industry now amongst Tibetologists. Well, they had a little fight over here, over in that province, and oh, there was a struggle between these two monasteries over there. And, oh, they're just horrible too, you know. They insist on that. They're determined to try to show that, but it's fake. Point is, as a whole, the country was not militarized. There was no national army to speak of. Then the 13th Dalai Lama, after being chased out by the British first, and then second by Zhao Erfeng, by the failing Manchu Empire's bloodthirsty general, a guy called Butcher Zhao, they called him in Tibet, who was sent by the Dowager Empress to kill the Dalai Lama in 1908. After he had been, they had an unpleasant audience in Beijing, and then the Dalai Lama escaped to England, to the English in India. So he had to escape in two directions. That 13th Dalai Lama did, and after that, he decided they better get a defense force, and he tried to build one. But basically, he failed to do that because, in spite of being Dalai Lama, because Tibet never was a theocracy, which people say. I'm sure that guy, New York Times guy, would have written theocracy, feudal. He's all into that guy. But Tibet never was a theocracy because Tibetan Buddhists, as you know, they don't believe in a creator God. Therefore, and the Dalai Lama, although a religious person, is a bodhisattva. And bodhisattvas are supposed to be there to serve ordinary beings. So he's the servant, and they're not scared of him, and they don't do what he says. When the Dalai Lama tells them this and that, they go, oh, yes, Your Holiness, yes, yes, yes. And then they run out and have a beer. And they don't do it. And they're not scared of him. And the monks refused to allow even the dumbest monks to join a defense force. You know, those I'm talking about, the Olympic monks, the toughy monks, the Dokdo monks. Those abbots came down, they marched down 13th Dalai Lama and said, no way, we're not having army. So the poor 13th Dalai Lama and then the Panchen Lama left the country even, not to pay taxes on the areas that he was, that were his endowment of the Tashi Lumbo monastery. The land was given to different monasteries as endowment, like you would give stocks today, because land, the yield of land was a 6% tax, so not even a 10% tax on land produce. Very bureaucratic and highly organized, the old literature, like big ledgers and things. It was not at all an informal sort of bunch of things, or even the nomads, very, very organized. Although they never made the stupid thing of fencing the steppe so that the nomads couldn't nomadize, because the reason they have to nomadize is so the yaks won't eat the grass down all the way in one place. Although the key to the Tibetan nomadism and why it's fake, it's presently claimed that the nomads have spoiled the steppe, it's a complete lie, is that yaks are weird. Did you know that? Yaks do not graze. Did you know that? Who knows that? It's agricultural science. Yaks are not grazers. Yaks are browsers, like you do in a bookstore. You browse. And why are they called browsers? Because yaks have a very sandpapery tongues. And when they see a bunch of grass in the steppe, they go up and they lick it. And that takes the blade off the root without damaging the root and without disturbing. They don't bite it like a goat or a sheep or a cow and therefore pull up the root. If you put too many sheep on a steppe, that will, yes, or goat especially, that will ruin the grass. But a yak just licks it, goes around licking the ground and getting the blades off the grass root and leaving the root intact. So that's why they can survive well and maintain well high altitude steppe. They eat a lot of grass and they yak around and then they poop and then that steppe grows flourishing fabulous grasses endlessly. And then they move when they've licked the blades off the roots as they browse their way through the giant, huge, vast Tibetan steppe, which is bigger, five times bigger than Texas. So, anyway, I'm digressing, so then they did this to the Mongolians, who were the most powerful empire in history on land, land empire. And they became all a bunch of wimps, too. So, So this is a very different view of history. One of the things that in America, for example, we are all taught, starting because of our legacy of the British education. Like, I went to a British school here in New York. And in the British school in New York, when I first went there in the 40s, they still used a switch. And if you didn't learn your Latin, you got whacked on the back of the legs. Now, very un-American, but it was very British, on 98th Street off Fifth Avenue. And we learned this, "Men of Harlech in the gloaming," you know, like spears, and then the Odyssey, the Iliad, it was a big thing, especially the Iliad was a big thing, you know, the Achilles and Hector and warriors, you know. It's a Rambo story. It's a total militaristic story, you know. It's just a war story. Because it's in Greek, it's all supposed to be so classic. But actually, it's just a war story, like the Mahabharata, glorifying war and heroic violence. And naturally, for a militarized society, that's a good thing to get the kids reading that. And then and our education, and we're taught that no country in history ever voluntarily demilitarized, and that you can't demilitarize, and you have to have a huge military, and therefore we pay for that huge military. And if you don't have that, someone's going to conquer you. And all militaristic countries teach a version of human nature that human beings suck and they have to be kept in line by force. Just like the Yellow Emperor's philosophy of legalism contra Confucius's theory and Mencius's theory in ancient China. So the history of India, Tibet, and Mongolia in particular, and actually all of the Asian countries influenced by Buddhism, tells another story, although those in which, as I will argue, Buddhism was countercultural. You know, because Thailand says, "We're a Buddhist country." Sometimes Japanese Buddhists will say, "We're a Buddhist country." They will say, for example. But, in fact, the power in the country was always held by emperor or shogun in Japan. So it was not impossible to start up Japanese colonialism and militarism in the late 19th century, the Meiji era. And very intriguingly, to kind of prove my thesis, one of the first things they did in the Meiji era, there were several things that they did. They forced all the monks to marry after 1867. All the monks had to get married. We're not going to have any... Because soldiers, basically, right, are sort of celibate, right? Because there's no girls in the army. Of course, then they do rape and looting and pillaging once they win a war somewhere in the old days. So they are not exactly have monk's vows. But they're stuck in all-male communities, so they leave behind their families, right? So monks also leave behind their families, but they actually have a vow, and they're totally celibate. And that makes them unmanageable as far as a militarized state goes. Because they get into their thing about being nonviolent and refusing orders and developing nirvana, and I'm not going to serve, I'm not going to pay taxes, I'm not going to do what the emperor tells me. And then when there are large groups of them, they resist. And they're more powerful in their resisting, and they have more land because they are not formed from a single family or clan. Whereas a parent cannot tell the emperor, you can't have my son. Nowadays, and daughter, and in America, but most places still my son. You can't have my son, you know, because I like him and I don't want him to get killed in your dumb war against the neighboring emperor for no good reason, which it doesn't help me. Don't tell me I'm protecting my family by having my son killed. So family can't do that. They'll come and take him away. Okay? So there's no way. But monks, they can resist. And they did in his history. So even a countercultural Buddhist country, the sort of attempt... Oh, yeah, I was going to say, yeah, Japan. So three things they did. They forced all the monks to marry, and they registered all the monasteries as private property of the abbots, who they also forced to marry, which must have been strenuous for some of the elder ones, but they did. And then all the Meiji government listed all monastic establishments and temples as private property of the abbots. This is why Zen monks in America, people who call themselves Zen monks nowadays, have like a girlfriend or two kids and a wife or whatever, and they go around and say, "I'm a monk." I've tried many times in conferences and things, "You guys are not monks. You're priests. That's fine. You're ministers, like Protestants. You can have a family, but you're not monks." But they won't listen. This happened to you only with the Meiji era forcing it to weaken the Buddhist Sangha in Japan. They made them marry. So that was one thing. Then the second thing, which is more significant almost, or no, but not more, but very significant also, they took the old Japanese tribal deities, Hachiman, the war god, etc., out of the monastery temples where they had been kept, under a theory by the Japanese Buddhists that these local deities, as it were supporting the Buddha Dharma, and that they were sort of bodhisattvas, and they liked Buddha, and they were like, so that the tribal thing, you know, the tribal blood thing, like we're the tribe, you know, we're going to fight the other tribe, so that was somehow semi-controlled by the more internationalist and sort of, universalist attitude of Buddhism. So that was the second thing that they did. And then they made the emperor into God, you know, and they pumped up nationalist Shinto, because Buddhism would not be in favor of them conquering China, which was the source of their Buddhism, or conquering Manchuria, or Korea, which also was the source of their Buddhism, was the pathway through which most Buddhism came to Japan, if not was the pathway where the Japanese came from, actually, although they don't like to acknowledge that, but that's a fact. And, you know, Buddhism was not in favor of that sort of thing. Unfortunately, most of the Buddhist groups were unable to resist the Japanese imperium in doing that, except the Lotus Sutra ones, what we jokingly sometimes call the Buddhist Muslims, only because they're more missionary, you know, they're more aggressive about trying to convert people. That's the Nichiren version of the Lotus Sutra people. And those guys, the really great thing about them, they used to sneak out into Manchuria, pretending to be soldiers wearing uniform, get to Manchuria, strip off their soldier's uniform, put on their robe and take out their drum and walk between the lines with bullets whistling by them and sometimes hitting them, saying, Namo no ho renge kyo, you know, Tina Turner's version of Buddhism, you know. Namo no ho renge kyo, they go down like that. And then the Chinese soldiers and the Japanese soldiers would stop shooting. So that was unacceptable to the Japanese colonialists, that, you know, somebody would be interrupting their war, like in World War I when German and British soldiers would stop to have Christmas, the generals would come and shoot a few captains. They were so angry about it. They wanted them to keep fighting. It was so stupid. Anyway, so even the countercultural Buddhist societies generally, I think, were generally more peaceful, which may explain one of the mysteries of history. Take, for example, gunpowder was invented by Chinese chemists, but never used for warfare until the Westerners started using it, and Turks and people like that, and then they also did to defend themselves. But and there are many examples like that where why are the Muslim countries from Iran and from Central Asia were able to conquer the Indians around 1,000 years ago, because the Indians had been somewhat more peaceful because of the presence, and modern Indian revolutionaries against the British knew that, and they write that, like a holy man like Sri Aurobindo used to complain about Buddhism bitterly, that the Buddhists, too much Buddhist asceticism, as he put it, spoiled India's martial might and enabled them to be conquered first by a different Islamic people and then by Christian, British and French and others, and Portuguese and Dutch. And they blame Buddhism for that, and they probably should on a political and social level. They do, you know, the vulnerability, you know, enlightenment and gentleness and sensitivity and nonviolence does go along with the degree of vulnerability. That is utterly true. And that's the light you have to put in. Now we're coming to Dalai Lama's. As the Dalai Lamas become people who have a message for the whole world, which this Dalai Lama, for the first time, of 14 of them, this one finally does, and he's talking about nonviolence and anti-militarism, and the 21st century must be a century of dialogue and not war, like the 20th century was and all the many centuries in the past, this is a really challenging statement and a challenging idea that he puts forward. And, of course, it's no wonder that rude guy writes the end of the Dalai Lama, you know, and he's run out of time, didn't work. Everybody goes, people say that. They say, even people who like the Dalai Lama, they say, oh yeah, but you know, this nonviolent thing of getting his people to getting a break from the Chinese colonial operation in Tibet nonviolently, that'll never work, and all this thing. Even his own brothers challenged this in the 50s and 60s, and certain right-wingers in the West also do. And how do you answer that, you know, in a way? Well, I have a good answer for it, actually, which is that world, you know, it goes back to Gandhi's answer. Do you know, did I tell you before Gandhi's statement to Churchill in the World War? Did I ever tell you that?
No.
He got in big trouble for it in the 1940, I think, 39, 40. Do you know that one? He said to them, he said, if you guys were really heroic and you really wanted to put a stop to Hitler, you would do so, you'd resist Hitler nonviolently. And you wouldn't fight Hitler violently, militarily. And people were like, oh, this is horrible. You know, like, they really freaked out. And then he said, well, okay, then after that, after they all started screaming in the press about how awful he was, he said, okay, well, look, let me clarify. Apparently, you're not capable of resisting nonviolently, but that would be the best way and the most effective. And the second best is to resist violently and overcome this kind of horrible aggression. So go ahead, go for it. And the worst is to surrender and start and join Hitler and do his bidding and act like, you know, become one of his troops. And I'm not recommending that. You seem to think by being nonviolent, I'm saying surrender and then do whatever Hitler tells you. But no, I'm saying resist nonviolently. That's the hardest thing to do. But what that would do, that would be defeat him from within. In other words, once you are resisting nonviolently, his troops are still human beings. And once they don't get any shots back, they're running people over with tanks and they might do that sort of thing. Sure, you'd lose a lot of people. But then the troops would rebel against this. They would not be wanting to continue people who are not resisting them. They would stop doing that. And then that would collapse his government and his whole thing, that his paranoia to his own people that you're being ringed by enemies and you have to go and attack and conquer them all because they're all defective and they're all this and all that. That would be the end of that. Because they would not follow that order, he said. And now, oh, you're so unrealistic, etc. They said, he would kill all of us, or many of us, he said. Yeah, and you'll get a lot of people who get killed when you fight violently, too. And it's a good question, which would be more? Gandhi's response to that was. And then his killer argument, though, was, okay, if you fight violently, you'll win, because there's more of you. But then your own societies will be taken over by Hitler-like people, he then said. And now your Western American will never agree to that. We'll never agree to that. Or anybody, I think your Russians, for at least during the Yeltsin period, the Gorbachev-Yeltsin period, they might have agreed with that about Stalin like that. They might say, yeah, Stalin did take over after that, and then the KGB ran Russia. And so, you know, they're fascists too. You know, they're a bunch of fascists too. I don't know about, maybe the democratic students in China from Tiananmen Square might have agreed with that about Mao. Killed 50, 60 million, maybe 40 million, whatever, with his ridiculous famines and things. They might have agreed with that then. Nowadays, they're re-promoting him as the living bodhisattva. But they might have agreed at that time. And Americans would never agree about CIA and certain kind of fascists in America who still are there, actually. Still invaded Iraq, I would say. I think you can say that. So Americans would not agree. Well, we've been nice ever since the war. We won the Great War, greatest generation. Well, it's our attitude. But I don't think a lot of people in Chile whose government was overthrown, a lot of different people around the world don't really appreciate our CIA special ops activities. And of course, the last shred of it was Vietnam was not appreciated by the Vietnamese. And it wasn't appreciated by my Chinese professors at Harvard, who told me, they begged McNamara, they said, don't worry about the Vietnamese and to think you're containing China by attacking the Vietnamese communists. Honor the agreement made in Geneva to Ho Chi Minh by the French. Don't jump in behind the French there because you'll get wasted, you can't manage. And you don't have to. They're going to be your big buddies once they have their independence. whatever they call themselves, socialist or whatever, but no, they wouldn't listen. So Gandhi's prophecy in some way is true, in the sense that the World War II militarism is still in charge worldwide. The A-bomb that was invented in the context of World War II is still lurking over everybody's head. And there were these moments of seemingly this would be over in the 80s, in the 90s, you know, with the cessation of Soviet Union and with various events, Tiananmen and Burma and others, but it's been stopped. And our invasion of Iraq. There's nothing that anybody was hung for at Nuremberg that the people who insisted on lying to us and invading Iraq should not be hung for, actually, if you really look at it. I'm sorry, I apologize to anybody who's a staunch Republican. But everywhere else on this planet, that's thought of as a fact, whatever you like about it, whatever you think about it here in America. It's a 100% unjustified invasion, which is they hung people in Nuremberg for what they call aggressive war, for invading Czechoslovakia without provocation. So in the quote-unquote post-UN New World Order, invading another country without direct provocation is considered a crime. I apologize for ruffling anyone's feathers with that, but it's a fact. So we are in a situation then where the idea of disarmament and of solving problems with dialogue seems to be its time has come, rather than, you know, out of time. Since then, too, who has won any wars? Has anybody been succeeded in any war winning, do you think, on this planet? Maybe even World War II, which is supposed to be the great holy war, and don't think that the World War II was engaged in to save the Jews, because the people, the Allies, they were not saving Jews, not at all. They wouldn't even let them land in their country when they escaped. It was not about that. They were all equally bad on that score in those days. So who has won a war lately? Tibet has not gotten a better deal for the Tibetan people, that's true, by nonviolent means. But how's Afghanistan doing? Do they have prospects of nice, peaceful, prosperous time after a lot of wars? I don't think so. They wrecked the entire place. Nobody's been winning wars. And actually, there's a great book which has nothing to do with Buddhism by a man which I recommend. I think it's on the list of recommended books if anybody takes up this topic. He's a friend of mine. He passed away now. He wrote about a nuclear explosion, great writer. It's called Power, The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People is the name of the... Jonathan Schell, that's right, that's his name. Thank you. Thank you, Brain. Jonathan Schell, S-C-H-E-L-L. And he invokes von Clausewitz, the Prussian theorist of war, classical political science Prussian theorist of war, you know, where, you know, the guy, war is diplomacy by other means, etc., and the object of war is to get a neighboring country who will not agree with your whatever you need from them. You know, you then defeat their army in the field, and then they surrender, and then you impose whatever treaty you wanted from them. And then therefore, is diplomacy by other means. But this key to the success of that, this guy argues, Schell, has to do with the fact that you only fight the enemy soldiers, you only defeat them till they surrender, you don't exterminate all the enemy soldiers, and collateral damage is under 5%, as far as maybe some soldiers running into some city and looting and pillaging. But since really the World War, and really the World War itself almost, it's not a matter of fighting soldiers in the field. And the collateral damage is 95%, and it's not collateral. It's the main damage. And then you have things like the Powell Doctrine, which was of ours, which was don't go to war unless you're going to obliterate the enemy country. So then there's nobody to impose any treaty on. Nobody's going to do what you want. It's like a stupid Cheney, one of his ways of trying to sell the war to a bunch of idiots here in our country, was that, oh, we'll pay for it by all the oil we'll get out of Iraq. You know, it'll become American gas, a Chevron gas station, you know, in the Middle East, that it will be, you know, Mary will come up to the pump and we'll pump out the Iraqi oil. which is why they bombed all the sewage and the electric and every kind of, you know, infrastructure system in Iraq to wreck the country so they would take it over. And he was going to have all their gas and oil. And he openly said so. You go back and look in the newspapers. Meanwhile, the U.S. can't get a decent contract. The French, Chinese, Russians are all getting the Iraqi oil contracts. And the Americans are not, because they're upset with us, which is right, since we wrecked the entire place. And even that didn't work. You know. So if it is a fact that war has become impossible, and so anyway, that's the Shell thesis, that because war now, the weapons of it are too powerful, that there is nobody left to make a deal with if you have all-out war. And of course, the ultimate of that is nuclear war, where the fallout and the radioactive cloud going around the planet, nuclear winter, all this kind of thing, it's just, forget it, you know, just completely impossible. Nobody's going to win that one either. And that's why we haven't had one in 60, 70 years, with a bunch of sub-intelligent people in charge of our, elected in our countries, and mutual countries. Substandard, that's right, substandard people running these countries. So if that's so, then this message of the Dalai Lama, a secular ethic message, that actually, going back to its, you know, in his Beyond Religion, his secular ethics, he bases himself, his theory, not on religion, not on Buddhist ideas. He wants to get totally away from that. He bases it on many studies about the natural gentleness of the human being, which are there, and he recites them, and he loves them. He's like all into these neuroscience people and any of those things who do these studies with babies, you know, and how they are and so on. And the whole idea of the, you know, his religion is kindness, he always says. My religion is kindness, you know, he always used to say. And, you know, we are these helpless creatures. You remember Mae West was famous by saying she relied on the kindness of strangers. But we all do. And when you're first born to your parents, you're a stranger. They don't know who you are. They don't know where you came from. Well, they think they came from their genes, so that makes them feel more comfortable. They don't know that you had a future life. Or if they're religious, they think you came from God. At least the Buddhists are more realistic. You came from a future life. They're not sure who you are. And they don't feel they own you quite the same way, because by the theory of karma, that people do who think they created you because you came out of their genes, you know, so you're their property. So if they're lawyers, you have to be a lawyer. Sort of thing, you know. Materialists, people get into that in families. Fathers, I think, do. They don't want any sort of hippie artist, a kid, you know, if they're like a stock trader. They want a master of the universe. And the boy, the girl should marry a master of the universe. And, you know, gentle, and then nursing, and then, like, helpless. And you're helpless till you're 20. And, then, you know, I know you think at 13 you're like, forget the parents. But at least my kids were like that. And that was fine. Never mind. That's okay. But then you're still worrying about them as a parent. And then right in the new economy, the kid graduates from wherever, Oxford, Harvard, moves back in with his parents, grandparents, because of the economy. Never mind. Point is, he bases himself on the fact that the human being is not well equipped for violence, actually. You could be a cobra. You know, you could be a crocodile, you could be like a lion, you know, and then you'd be well equipped for violence within your evolutionary niche. But as a human, you have like no claws, no just soft skin, like forget about it. You're helpless for a decade, at least. And so based on that, it's actually an imposition against the human nature to become a violent killer. It takes a lot of indoctrination to get some guy to... I think I would say a lot of you who might go to McDonald's and eat chicken fingers, or what is it, chicken's livers and chicken whatever, it might be give you pause to go to an old-fashioned kitchen and have to go out and wring the chicken's neck and like pull its feathers out and then boil it. You know, they take a hold of the head and they go like that and break the neck, and then they rip the head off, and then they pull off the feathers, and then they pull off the skin, and then it's horrible. Now, you might all have trouble with that next time. But we can, you know, when it's pre-prepared, then we can have some chicken, whatever. And, you know, I'm not claiming to be holy on that self-score either. But the point is, his whole thing, therefore, just based on that. And actually, that's the same as Shakyamuni did.
Shakyamuni Buddha, his theory of karma, and I've already talked about it, so I won't repeat it, was also a kind of secular ethic of his time.
In other words, he was saying to people, don't do like this, don't kill, and don't do that, don't lie, you know, don't nurse grudges and have a hateful, malicious mind, because this will be bad for you. It will shape your being in a negative direction. And of course, that was very, very powerful thought. If your mind is part of evolution, once your own mind or soul is part of evolution and it goes on after you die, then the consequences of how you live become so much more impactful. The worry or the concern about the consequences become more impactful. So that was a very powerful secular ethic that Shakyamuni developed. And the Dalai Lama does the best he can with materialist science making the mainstream reality consensus in our society. And he bases his nonviolence and his we must have dialogue theory on that idea of the gentleness of the human being. And I have a slogan like that. Did I tell you my slogan? It's called From Mad to Mud. It's my slogan. What is mad? Mutual assured destruction. Right? And isn't that, that's the doctrine of anti-nuclear war doctrine. Mutual assured destruction. Right? The danger there is, you know, crazy person might start that off. And maybe, you know, then it will all kindle, you know. Or even a computer, like in that great movie. Did you ever see that movie about the kid who hacked the computer? The computer was starting a war game between the U.S. and Russia. What was that called? War Game? War Game. I don't know if you ever saw that film. But that was really great. There was the best line in that, which I really liked, was the general. When the kid was going to do something by getting to a back door, and then one of the captains or lieutenants in the computer room there said, well, what do you think, General? Should we let him try it? He said, well, sure, man. I'd piss out a spark plug if I thought it would help. Remember that line? I always stuck with me, that line. I don't know why. That actor was good. He had a good southern accent. Anyway, I liked it. I apologize for the indelicate reference. So, mud means mutual unilateral disarmament, which is a paradox, but that's very Buddhistic. Mutual unilateral disarmament. And what I always think of that as is as a situation where two people have drawn guns aimed at each other, and they decide they're tired of holding this gun aimed at the other guy, and actually one of them might twitch or something, and then they both die, because the one who was hit first would just have a death twitch, and his gun would go off. And so they decide to put them down and to get out of that particular bind. And so then when they do it, though, they're very suspicious of each other, so they're watching like this as they're lowering the guns, the pistols, with their fingers still on the trigger. But then when they get to a certain level at the table where they're going to let go of the gun, there is an element of risk where the other one can pick it up quickly and shoot. So that's where it becomes unilateral. So each one decides that the other situation is just not viable and they're just going to go for it and take the risk. But it's very little left because both are down like that. But there still is a risk. So that's the unilateral part. Mutual is where you're watching the other guys at the same point that you are. And you put it down like that. Anyway, that's my slogan. Mad to mud. You know. And somehow it didn't go, though. I didn't get it on the whatever. It didn't go viral. Not yet. But that's what he's doing.